Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon and hope that we'll have a few things that we can share about the West Virginia University Farming Systems project. Today, what I'd like to do is go over four major items. First, give sort of an overview of organic agriculture from my perspective. Secondly, talk about the WVU Organic Farming Systems Project, which has been ongoing for about 10 years now. I will talk about some of the yield and soil quality data we've collected from our long-term farming system studies, and finally finish up with some topics on pest management. By way of introduction, I am a plant nematologist. This is the first time I've ever been to a meeting of the Soil Science Society. And for the bulk of my early years, I was working with a variety of nematicides in the fruit and vegetable industry, which are among the most toxic pesticides used in agriculture, and they're applied at the highest rates labeled for use, and they all contaminate groundwater. And so there are a whole variety of environmental issues that we were working on during the early years. Unfortunately for my career, there have not been a lot of new nematicides being registered in the last 20 or 30 years. And so a lot of my emphasis shifted into work on rotation crops, cultural pest management, biological controls. And that led to the formation of our project in 1998, when our dean got tired of hearing from organic growers and saying, why don't you ever do anything for us? We pay our taxes too, et cetera, et cetera. That was coupled with a large SARE grant that we received to begin work on organic farming systems. We had a lot of introduction to the history of organic agriculture this morning, and I'm not going to repeat a lot of that. In essence, when I ask people what is their definition of organic, they come up with a lot of different topics, a lot of different terminology, a lot of different concepts, all of which involve concepts about not using pesticides, no using synthetic chemicals, don't do this, don't do that, and none of that really meets the legal definition of organic. The organic definition, as defined by the Organic Food Production Act, is a system of agriculture conducted in compliance with the Organic Food Production Act and its subsequent regulations, of which there are about 160 pages. And as a result of the promulgation of those rules, organic agriculture and the use of that term is now essentially a regulated term, and to use that term, you need to be doing it in compliance with that set of rules. But it's a lot more than the things that you can't do. It's a very knowledge-intensive approach to agriculture. It is typically a highly diversified production system. A detailed crop rotation is one of the requirements of an organic production system. Most organic growers believe that you have to have livestock on a farm. You can't have an organic farm without livestock. At the same time, it's also true that about 80% of organic growers in America do not have livestock on their farming system, and so we're involved in testing that approach. It's generally acknowledged to be an ecologically based system. It's one that emphasizes biological and cultural pest controls, and as we heard, there's a big focus on soil quality. Most importantly, it's a readily identifiable consumer label. If you ask the average customer who knows nothing about how their food is produced, they know what that term organic means. At least they think they do. And it clearly carries the implication that there's improved environmental sustainability, there's a belief that it has enhanced nutrition, and that there are social benefits, some of the things that Michelle Wander talked about this morning. The key thing for us as agricultural scientists is that there is a very significant shift in American agriculture that's underway, as more and more demand for organic products continues and there's more support for organic agriculture. One of the key things that we started out with in our project was to convene a grower advisory committee, a group of organic growers who wanted to get involved in our project and who wanted to ask the university to be involved in organic agricultural research. And this is actually a fairly important slide. There were some key things about organic growers that altered some of my conceptions as a researcher. Why are they organic? First, some of them are concerned about sustainability and their environmental impact of agriculture. And that's their primary motivation. Some of them are organic because they are chemically sensitive. They literally break out in rashes and hives and get sick when they use synthetic chemicals. They cannot farm conventionally. Some are concerned because they want to improve food quality and nutrition, and that's a major driving force behind their production. Some of them are strictly in it for the money. That price premium is very attractive. There are some growers who are growing organically because they would be out of business if they were trying to farm conventionally. They don't really believe in this stuff or anything, but they get a better price for their product, so they grow organically. Some of them simply are tired of the commodity market working for the large processor and wholesaler. They enjoy meeting individually with their customers. They like that one-on-one personal relationship. And organic growers often tend to market in a direct marketing setup through farmers markets and farm stands and so on, where they have a much more personal relationship with their customer. And there are some who are doing it because they believe that organic is better without having any of these rationalizations or justifications. It's almost on the scale of a religious belief. Regardless, and here is the key point, none of those reasons for growing involve a direct comparison of the yield of an organic system versus the yield of a conventional system. And coming from an agricultural background and a conventional system such as I have, where yield is the driving be-all and end-all of production, this is a real shift. Their short-term yields are not their ultimate rationale for choosing to grow organically, and we have to recognize this if we want to serve the organic grower. There are a lot of things that you can't do, and when you ask people what their definition of organic is, some of them focus on the things you can't do. You can't use pesticides, and you can't use synthetic fertilizers, and no genetically modified organisms, no sewage sludge. In livestock, there's no antibiotics or hormones or synthetic medications that are allowed. And you can adhere to this in every single step and adopt what is known and was described this morning as the organic by neglect approach to organic farming. This is not an integrated, knowledge-intensive approach. This is the just focusing on what you can't do. I tend to prefer the approach to organic agriculture about what the things you can do and what you are expected to do with an organic system. It's an opportunity to use more knowledge, to use a variety of softer technologies that are not as debilitating to natural biocontrol agents or natural fertility products. It's an opportunity to grow more diverse products and to actually implement a soil building rotation rather than one that's simply the bare minimum. Mostly it involves, and I believe there's fairly good evidence, a healthier environment, a more sustainable agricultural system, one that leaves the land better than it was. I want to give a little bit of global context because these are a couple of other points that I think are important for us as agricultural scientists. As of the last time I was able to collect data about 2 years ago, the U.S. imports about $8 in organic food for every $1 that it exports. That trade gap is widening, and widening very rapidly. America does not produce enough food organically. We cannot meet our own consumer demand for organic products. And it's a bit of a shock to me as an agricultural scientist from a land-grant institution to acknowledge that this is a country that we are, as a country, are not self-sufficient in organic food. We do not produce enough. There is simply way more demand than we've got production, and there are too many barriers to that transition from conventional production to organic production for American farmers to meet that demand. Where we do export, most of our largest exports are to Europe and Japan, mostly because they pay even better price premiums than American consumers do. Most of our imports are coming from China, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Southeast Asia, Central America, and similar countries. The Western University Organic Farm Project began in 1999. Really, our planning began in 1998. We were certified in 2003 after a three-year transition project process. One of the things that came about as we started our planning was input from our grower advisory committee. You know, when we start talking about farming systems, the first thing I wanted to do is compare an organic system with a conventional system. Well, if you look at the reasons why organic growers are growing organically, they don't care. They're already organic. They don't really worry about what that comparison with conventional systems is. What they want to know are, what are organic systems that they can use that will help them be better organic growers? Do we need to look at and incorporate livestock? Can we import fertility in the form of compost? What kinds of crop rotations work best? And those are the kinds of systems that we focused on. We do want to emphasize, and our farm does emphasize, a lot of whole systems research, as well as some smaller pest management, soil fertility, weed control type component research. In addition to the farm, we have done a number of on-farm grower trials, trying to extend that information to growers. I've already talked about our grower advisory committee. Student involvement is very important in the organic farm project at WVU. Students do a vast majority of the labor. Graduate students do many of the research projects. They're critical components of this, and it's very much a student-centered activity. Speaking of students, we've got a new major that came about as a result of this project in agroecology. We offer a number of undergraduate internships every summer, as well as graduate research opportunity. And we've had a number of new crop production courses in organic agriculture that have been developed and that are feeding into our agroecology major. A major focus of the project is to understand long-term farming systems. Organic growers acknowledge that it takes time to do this transition. The very reason for a three-year transition project is to build up the soil biota and the fertility mechanisms and the nutrient recycling mechanisms that don't reappear overnight. We also wanted to look at construction and development of biocontrol populations to help manage pests. We wanted to look at population dynamics of those pests. And of course, yield and economic inputs have to be done over multiple years. We've designed what we call a high-input system in which we've identified crop rotations and a farming system that depends largely on importing large volumes of dairy manure compost for soil building and fertility. We compare this with a low-input system, which involves building soil fertility solely with rotations and legume cover crops, winter crops, plowed in as green manures. And our question there is whether we can build and maintain soil quality without the use of off-farm inputs. We also wanted to look at integration of crop and livestock production to determine whether livestock production on a farming system can in fact take advantage of resources and use crop byproducts that don't otherwise have a market, and can we improve the value-added component with the livestock production. In our farming system, we've used sheep. To a large extent, that's because of the plot size in our crop production system. We found that we can either graze three sheep or one half of a cow, and one half of a cow does not graze very efficiently. We also have a fairly significant poultry production project. Dr. Joel Moritz is our poultry scientist who has been involved in this work for about 7 or 8 years now, looking at a variety of poultry nutrition, looking at alternative breeds, looking at use of probiotics to help suppress salmonella and other foodborne bacteria. A major focus of the farm has been on soil quality. We define that as both its physical and chemical structure, the fertility, as well as the soil biota, the bacteria, the fungi, nematodes, various soil insects and arthropods, and earthworms, annelids. So, to get into the third part of my talk and where we start actually looking at some data, we've had long-term farming systems that have been ongoing in the same plot since 1999. Two market garden vegetable production systems have been in effect, where we have a four-year crop rotation among crop families. Pumpkins and zucchini have been our cucurbits, tomato and pepper as the solanaceous crops, green bean and peas for legumes, And we have this arbitrary family that we call leafy vegetables, which has consisted of spinach and lettuce. Asteraceae and Chenopodiaceae for the plant science taxonomist purists in the group, but they're leafy vegetables. Four replicates of each of those plots established with versus without the annual compost application. In the field crop system, we have a four-year rotation consisting of potato, soybean, wheat, and rapeseed. This is a continuously cultivated cropping system without livestock. A second system with livestock involves that same 4 years of cultivated crop, followed by three additional years of an orchard grass, red clover, pasture, and hay system. So we have essentially a permanent rest period trying to further build soil quality. That's in a factorial system with and without compost, with three replicates of each plot. This is just sort of an indication of the amount of compost that is applied with compost versus without. We're applying the compost, originally started out as 10 tons per acre dry weight each year. We have since shifted that to 20 tons per acre on every other year, specifically for the potato and the wheat crops. So we get the maximum return on those crops that respond best to the additional fertility. After 10 years of this application, you can actually see a physical difference in the soil, just in terms of the color, the crumb nature of the soil, and so on. Yield data have been all over the place. Had very respectable yields the first couple of years, followed by a couple of years of complete crop failure in potatoes. They've been slowly building up over the last several years. Something in the neighborhood of 10,000 kilograms per hectare would be considered an acceptable level. We're still not there yet. And when we compare the four farming systems, low versus high input, with and without the animal rotation, there does seem to be a consistent improvement in yields with response to the compost. We do not necessarily see that in response to the livestock production. And rather than look at a lot of data, I'm going to summarize these yield data. With compost, potato yields were greater than without for six of the 8 years for which we have data. They were statistically significant improvement in four of those 8 years. And the only years where the compost plots actually were lower than in the unamended plots were when we had complete crop failure. Plots with livestock rotation tended to have lower yields in seven of the 9 years, and that was statistically significant three of the 9 years. And everything I've told you about the first 9 years is incorrect because this year we had very different results. Ultimately, what I'd have to conclude from these experiences is that our crop yields are still limited by soil fertility, particularly nitrogen. We are having difficulty getting enough nitrogen for optimum yields, even with a legume-rich, compost-amended system. We also have significant problems with weed management. In our climate, April, May, June tend to be very rainy months, and there are frequently times when you simply cannot get into the field to till because of the frequent rainfall in time to keep the weeds under control. And that weed management is still an ongoing struggle, and we deal with it every year. Interestingly enough, with the price premiums we get for potatoes, we can actually afford to pay students to go out and hoe and hand weed the plots. It is an economically feasible approach, so there is definitely something. The third component that we have to deal with in our farming system is water availability. We do not irrigate. In some small plot trials where we have included irrigation, the yields are at least double or triple what we get here. And that was especially true this summer when we had a prolonged dry spell just as the tubers were beginning to bulk. Soil fertility. The plots in 1999 had been in an apple orchard and long-term ground cover of grasses and various mixed grasses. And when we plowed that fall, we saw a very pronounced drop in soil organic matter content. Over the next 3 years, the compost didn't seem to have a significant effect on soil organic matter. In the subsequent 5 years, we've seen a steady separation of those four treatments. plots with compost, the dark field symbols, and tend to have significantly higher soil organic matter content than those without compost. Likewise, plots where we have the with livestock rotation, 3 years of red clover and orchard grass, also seems to be building organic matter. And in some of those years, that separation is statistically significant, not every year. The take-home message from this chart is that long-term systems really do matter. If we had conducted our first 4 years of study and republished this when we'd finished in 2003, our conclusion was that, yes, we get significantly better yields with compost than without, but that we really can't affect soil quality in terms of soil organic matter content. If we look at those results after 2007, 2008, we get pretty much the opposite result. You do get sort of a yield response, but those low input plots are catching up in terms of yield. We are seeing a significant enhancement in soil quality as a result of the compost, and we've seen a significant enhancement in soil organic matter content, even in the low input plots, based solely on winter cover crops, green manure, and a legume-rich rotation. And I would argue that this is very compelling evidence for the need for long-term farming system studies, because if we look at the average 3 or 4 year grant from USDA, we would have come up with the wrong answer compared to what we do with a long-term sustained project. We looked at other soil fertility measurements. This is soil potassium. Again, by 2003, we are starting to see some separation in terms of soil potassium, but again, the differences become more pronounced over time as we add the compost. We don't see as much of a response to the with livestock response as you would expect. We're not actually adding any potassium with our crop rotation. The same is also true with the soil phosphorus. Again, the with compost treatments do tend to separate versus the without, the high input versus the low input. Livestock treatments are showing some separation. One of the key things that I think is important is the comparison of the open squares, the high input with livestock versus the, high input no livestock versus the high input with livestock, which are the closed squares in the solid line. With the animals, we end up with a 7-year rotation, which means we've only been applying compost twice in every 7 years instead of twice every 4 years in the rotation without livestock. And I think over a long period of time, we're starting to see those cumulative changes in soil fertility. The long and the short and the take-home of this message is that it does take a long time to build soil organically. The 3-year transition period is a very minimum, at least in our soils, which tend to be heavier silt loam soils. And we actually see continuing improvement for a period now exceeding 10 years. We looked at some biological measures of soil. As a plant nematologist, the first thing I want to look at are the plant parasitic nematodes. Pratelenchus is the lesion nematode. It has a very broad host range. Over the course of the 8 years, the samples went up and the samples went down. And after 2003, I had kind of given up on sampling these nematodes because a typical damage threshold is around 100 Pratelenchus per 100 cubic centimeters of soil, not 15 or 20. And we were just not getting anywhere. And I was very frustrated with this because as a plant nematologist, I'm monitoring nematodes. They're present. We're growing a suitable host. We're not controlling anything. We're even growing good hosts as winter cover crops, and the nematode populations just aren't doing anything. This is very depressing. There's nothing more boring than a healthy crop for a plant pathologist. And it was only after a couple of years of looking at these data that I realized that, coming from the school of positive thinking, anytime you think you have a problem, what you really have is an opportunity waiting to be recognized. And I realized we have suppressive soils here. And so I went back to monitoring these populations. And sure enough, the populations are still being suppressed. And we've identified a fairly broad range of biocontrol agents for these plant parasitic nematodes. None of which by themselves seem to be particularly significant, nor are we able to associate those with any of the farming systems treatments we've had. So there's a big puzzle there that, stay tuned. We've looked at some of the other nematode species as indicators in the soil. Mononks are predatory nematodes. These are the ones that eat the parasites. They're sort of the shark in the waters, the fox in the rabbit warren, et cetera. Their populations jumped all over the place. The difficulty with them, and these are the dominant predators in our nematode community in these soils, not only are they predators, but they are cannibalistic. When their population gets too high, they eat their young. Not a very good habit if you want to build up a suppressive predator population. This is Mononcus on the right feeding on, I think in this case it's just a bacterial feeding nematode. They have a very large, isn't that beautiful? Right after lunch too, very large mouth cavity with a tooth that cuts open the body contents of their prey and literally sucks out the intestines. In many cases, they will eat them whole. This is not my slide. Forgot to put the credit on there, but I've had a few pictures of these over the years. The difficulty is that they're very difficult to get pictures of because they will consume and swallow their prey in about 30 seconds. And by the time you see one and get the camera set up, they're gone. So it's good to get a good picture once in a while. We looked at bacterivores. This morning, Steve Diver talked about the ratio of fungi to bacteria as an indicator of soil quality. Nematologists looked at the ratio of fungivores to bacterivores as indicating the same thing. Bacteria and soil are great, but it's the nematodes eating the bacteria that really run the system, right? They do tend to be a top-down regulated community, and so the predators and carnivores and bacterivores do tend to regulate many of those microbial systems. Again, we do tend to see higher bacterivore populations in those plots with compost. You add a big slug of organic matter and bacterial populations build up to degrade that organic matter. And of course, the bacterivores that feed on the bacteria also build up in response to that. The difficulty is that these are very short cycle, short life cycle organisms. Generation time is about 3 days, and their entire life cycle of population builds, blooms, and collapses in about 2 weeks. And so timing is everything in sampling these, and it becomes very data intensive to really follow this. We looked at a number of other indicators to compare the nematode community structure in plots with compost versus plots without. Tilanx are plant parasites and fungivores. Aphalanx are also fungivores. We looked at total bacterivores because there's a large number of those in the soil. We looked at the predator population comparing with and without compost. We looked at the ratio of plant parasites to bacterivores, and we looked at the fungivore to bacterivore ratio. And after 8 years, none of those are statistically significant. There's a very excellent farming systems study at the Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan where they're seeing these results. Deb Nair, who is now at Vermont, has shown consistent results with nematode community structure. Howard Ferris at California showing that these community structure indicators are very good indicators of what's happening with soil and the response to soil management. And none of those are true in West Virginia. We just can't see a difference. We looked at earthworms. Earthworm population dynamics are very useful as indicators of soil quality. Ask any organic grower. And there is some truth to that. If we look at the population of earthworms when we started and first plowed down that nice grass sod, it went from about 250 per square meter down to less than 50 in the first year. With compost, they rebounded after the second year. We see a lot of variation, but the general trend for the first 4 or 5 years is that organic farming, either with or without compost, is not very good for earthworms. And it wasn't until after a couple of years that I realized the rationale for this. We had gone from a system that was in a more or less permanent grassland to one where we were tilling every year and even several times a year. And if you think of an earthworm burrow from the standpoint of your home, and if a large rototiller came through your house 3 times a year, how long would you still be living there? Would your population likely decline? And I think that's what we're seeing. In a number of our plots, when we shifted to a lower tillage no-till planting at least 2 out of 4 years, we do see some rebound in earthworm populations. There is a general trend that if you add organic matter, earthworm populations do increase, but the tillage is clearly the big indicator of soil quality and the impact on earthworm communities, much more so than our management systems. We looked at the with and without livestock system. With livestock, when we have 3 years of a grassland, it's a nice permanent home for those earthworms. Their populations do build up, and then the next year we plow it down and plant potatoes and till those 3 times, and the earthworm population collapses again. So tillage is clearly very correlated, and it's a key factor in earthworm populations. It is not, you know, something that's easily managed otherwise. The final topic I'm going to cover is some of our pest management trials over the periods. How are we doing on time?
It would take about 6 or 7 more minutes.
I'll be through that in then. We looked at a variety of different diseases, insects, and weed control practices. Most of these tended to be short-term problems. First one that I spent a lot of time with are seeds and seed rots. Conventional growers for about the last 60 to 70 years have been planting seeds that have this funny pink powder over them. And they've been using these seeds treated with this pink powder for so many years that they've forgotten why they do that. Well, that pink powder is a fungicide that helps to suppress fungal infection of the seed after planting. Organic growers cannot use synthetic fungicides and have to use untreated seed. And I ask organic growers if they have problems with seed rots. And they say, oh, no, we're organic. We don't have diseases. It is poorly understood by growers, but they will sometimes admit that, yeah, they get poor seed emergence. But that's a problem with the seed, right? Well, no, these pathogens like Pythium and Fusarium are very widespread in soils. Most of the commercially available seed treatments are not particularly effective. We did some trials looking at 10 different organic treatments for seed rot control. We tried ridge planting as a cultural control to basically mound up the soil to allow faster warming of the soil and improve drainage. We did some pre-germinating of the seed with the expectation that pre-germinated or even transplant seedlings would be more resistant to the Pythium. We looked at soil solarization, which turned out to be very effective but not very practical. Looked at compost and compost tea and a fish emulsion as a soil amendment, and we looked at some biological seed treatments that are commercially available. Bottom line is that the pre-germination of the seed gave much faster emergence and much higher total emergence. The compost in furrow also gave fairly good emergence, but none of those ever got as high as 20% of the seed that survived Pythium. And in some of the treatments, as a plant pathologist, I was really pleased. I was able to kill off over 90% of the seeds that we planted. You know, excellent disease garden there. The one that kind of stuck out was the compost tea, which is that bottom line. We applied a dairy manure compost tea as a soil drench at planting and got significantly worse seed emergence than with tap water. So as a bottom line, that pre-sprouting seemed to work the best, and what we've gone now with a trial where we transplant, that should be 7 to 14 day old seedlings, my apologies, seedlings that are actually up to 14 days old are transplanted directly into the field. We don't normally transplant garden peas here in the United States, but it is apparently widely used in Belgium, where our horticulturalists recommended it, and it produced by far the earliest yields and the highest yields. And based on our economic analysis, this would actually be a significant, very economically effective approach. Solarization and the in-furrow compost treatments do give a significant enhancement in emergence and help suppress Pythium infection. Often the solarization is much for as much of a year, but it is still not the kind of 80 to 90% emergence that we get when we transplant the older seeds. The compost tea drench, again, did significantly worse than the controls. Another important disease we have are some foliar diseases. Tomato early blight and Septoria leaf blights are a common problem in organic tomatoes. We did some work with cultivar resistance, looking at variety trials, and looking at intercropping as well as some compost tea sprays. This is a project that a graduate student of mine proposed, and I said, well, all right, it's your thesis, go ahead and try it, but it'll never work. The goal was to establish plots that had 64 tomatoes, an 8 by 8 square, with either a monoculture of a susceptible cultivar Brandywine, which is a very popular heirloom variety, or a plot where every other tomato was Brandywine and the odd tomato was a resistant variety Celebrity. We measured both early blight lesion growth and disease progress after inoculating the plot. And I was shocked and amazed to find that, in fact, both the lesion growth rate and the overall disease progress were significantly faster in the monoculture than in the intercrop plots on a susceptible variety. And that suggests that we are seeing some form of induced systemic resistance with that intercropping. We looked at a whole variety of different compost teas, and suffice it to say that none of those results are statistically significant or different from the control. There are many organic growers that can make compost tea work. I am not one of them. Finally, I've done some trials with powdery mildew on pumpkin. These nice white blotches. It's a white powdery lesion on the leaves that leads to necrotic spots that leads to premature defoliation, and that reduces the overall yield. More importantly, the fungus will also infect the stem, the pedicel going into the fruit. And how many people have ever carved a jack-o'-lantern when the handle breaks off? A pumpkin without the handle is worth less than half the amount as a pumpkin with the handle. And so that pedicel infection and decay is actually a very serious economic problem with powdery mildew. And we compared a variety of organic products. Sonata is a bacterial preparation. Milstop is a commercially available form, potassium bicarbonate, which is analogous to sodium bicarbonate or baking soda, and milk. Many growers simply spray milk on theirs and are insisting that it works. Bottom line is that the combination of Sonata and Milstop did give us, that's the green line, the best protection of the foliage, but by the end of the growing season, all of those plots were pretty well defoliated as well. And there was no significant difference in defoliation at the end of the season. Likewise, there was not a significant difference among treatments in yield or in total amount of disease. But we did get this very interesting result that those plots that have the least amount of disease and have the longest green area, leaf area remaining tend to have the highest yields, about three times the yield of those plots with the greatest amount of disease. We looked at some biocontrol agents of Mexican bean beetle with this parasitic wasp. Works great. We looked at a variety of weed control practices. My bottom line conclusion is that there are a lot of options for weed management, and all of them are pretty labor intensive. Our number one problem in West Virginia have been the vertebrate pests, deer and groundhogs. And I will conclude by indicating that once the deer have learned where the soybeans are, it's very hard to break that habit. Groundhogs are even worse. We've developed an integrated pest management program for groundhogs. Every one of those will work for a little while. Nothing works for very long. And you kind of have to do all of them to get reasonably good control in our system. Number five, since WVU Organic Research Farm is technically within the city limits, the use of firearms is prohibited, and I have no evidence whatsoever that anyone on our staff would ever discharge a firearm at a groundhog. Really, seriously. I was always looking the other way. My final slide, integrated pest management for organic producer has a number of problems compared to conventional growers. The IPM philosophy accepts a certain minimal level of the pest and responds only when the population reaches an outbreak level. But the organic approach relies on prevention, taking action before you've got an outbreak of the pest. Tactics that work at these low pest levels aren't going to work very well often under high pest pressure, and organic growers therefore have to rely on a lot of different pest tactics, sort of like our integrated pest management program for groundhogs, all of which might give 2 or 3 or 4% control, but none of them give the 90% control that you want to look for. And so you have to put together a lot of these systems to make the whole system work to get good pest control. And this is why I believe that the organic by neglect approach is not really an organic farming system, because an organic production system has to be very knowledge intensive and very management intensive, putting together a lot of different problems. My final point for the Soil Science Society, That soil quality reliance that many growers have certainly helps suppress some pests, such as my favorite nematodes. We clearly have a suppressive soil there. But it may actually exacerbate some of the other pest problems. Our worst weed problems are the plots with compost. So with that, I'll be happy to take questions if we have a minute or two.